Parshat Vayera, which we'll read with God's help this Shabbat, is a parsha which contains within it tremendous amount of moral lessons, stories and directives for our lives. A quick overview of the parsha, and we'll be speaking about a number of the points within the shiur itself. Parsha opens, unfolds with Abraham inviting in the three guests who are angels who came to visit the sick. Abram just had his circumcision to tell Sarah the good news that she would have a child. And one was involved in overturning the city of Sodom, saving Lot. Abraham greets them with real royalty. And we have the details of Achnasat Orchim, inviting in the guests in the beginning of the parsha. We then move to the interchange, very powerful prayer that Abraham offers on behalf of the city of Sodom so that they should not be destroyed. And he bargains with God if there are 50 righteous people in the city, ultimately ending off if there are 10. God said if there were 10 righteous people, I wouldn't destroy it. However, there are not 10 righteous people, and the city will need to be destroyed. The parasha continues with the actual destruction of the city of Sodom, with Lot being saved, and what we mentioned last week, the incestuous relationship where Moab and Ammon, those two nations come from it, Moab, Me'av, from his father. The name of the child reflects this. We then have the fact that Abram is forced to go down to the Philistines because of a famine. Sarah is once again taken by the royal court and is left unharmed. The birth of Yitzchak, the climax. Ultimately, Yishmael, his stepbrother, Hagar's son, has to be thrown away since they cannot really grow up together. He's not a proper influence. And then the end of the parsha, the climax of Abraham Avinu's life, the most difficult section in the parsha, if not perhaps in the whole Torah. It's the command for Abraham to take his son and sacrifice it to God. The Akedas Yitzchak. It's this end of the parsha that I'd like to focus our attention this morning. Instead of sacrificing his son, the Torah tells us that when the Malach, the angel, came down and says, don't touch this young lad, don't do anything to him, Avraham Avinu lifts up his eyes. There it was a ram that was caught in the bushes, and a ram is offered in place of Isaac. On this, the Medrash in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer states the following. And this is what I'd like to focus in on today, to really have an understanding of what Medrash is all about. When our rabbis tell us ideas, there's a tremendous amount of depth contained in these ideas. The Medrash says the following. This is source number one, Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, chapter 31. It says, Oto ayul shenivra ben hashmashot. This ram that was created ben hashmashos between the twilight of the sixth day and Shabbos. Lo yatsa mimenu davar levatala. Nothing that came from this was for naught. Everything, every aspect, every part of this ayil was used later on. Afaro shel ayil, the ashes of the ram, who yisod shel mizbeach ha-pnimi, became the foundation of the altar, the inner altar in the temple. Gidin shelo, the sinews, haya la'asara nivalim shel kinur shaya davi minagembo, became the strings on the harp that King David played. Oro hu ezor or v'mafnav shel Eliyahu. The skin became the belt that Elijah the prophet wore. And then the Medrash continues that the left horn was blown at Mount Sinai and the right horn will be blown in the time of Mashiach. So in first glance, this Medrash is very perplexing. On second glance, it's also perplexing. What is the Medrash mean when it says that no part of this ram was left unused? Now clearly, we all understand that we're not talking about this on a literal level. It's not that God took the skin of the ram and then preserved it so that Elijah the prophet, thousands of years later, would be able to wear a belt. That's not what we're talking about. We're clearly talking about symbolically that all these aspects of this ram, whether it's the ashes that were used for the altar, whether it is the sinews that were used as the strings of the harp of David HaMelech of King David, the belt for Elijah from the skin, and the two horns, one that was blown at the time of Mount Sinai in the giving of Torah, and one in the future, all contain for us directives, all contain for us lessons, and we need to understand, and this is the one question of the morning, what is the symbolism of this ram? What are the messages that this Medrash is trying to teach us? So let's try to step back for a moment and first take a look at what was the thought process that was in Avraham Avinu's mind when he offered up this ram. Then let's try to understand what is the ram all about itself. And only then can we try to find an inner connection, inner theme among all the aspects of the ram for a lesson for our lives. Let's start with the thought process of Avraham Avinu. Or Gedayahu Rav Gedayah Shur Tzatzal. This is in source number 2 and 3. He says, based on the Sfasemet, that when Avraham Avinu went to sacrifice his son, this is the fourth line, Uva'era Sfat Emet, ki be'ein shalach Avraham lishchod et Yitzchak la'olah, Yadan ki kol kiyum klal Yisrael talui b'Yitzchak. He understood that the continuation of the Jewish people was dependent on his son. Uva'et asher yishchot b'no asher mimenu atid libano klal Yisrael yitbatel kol hakavod machut shemayim asher atid latzei mibnei Yisrael. And he understood very clearly that if Isaac were to be sacrificed and were to be killed, and Isaac at that point, Yitzchak Avinu was not married, the end of the Jewish people would occur right then and there. There would be no more Jewish people. So in Avraham Avinu's mind, the mindset is he's entering in to the sacrifice of Isaac with the understanding that he right now is not only sacrificing a son, but what he's doing is he's ending the Jewish people right here and then and now. And we know that the whole point of the Jewish people is to bring about a kvod gilui malchus shamayim, a sanctification, a revelation of God's name into this world. So therefore, Avraham Avinu, in every part and action that he placed into the sacrifice of his son, or ultimately into this ram, every action was in a sense an action to bring about a gilui kvod Hashem, a revelation of God, so that all future revelations that the Jewish people would accomplish in the future would be accomplished now, and the job of the entire Jewish people would be done at that very moment. If this is the case, when although Avraham Avinu was not successful, in terms of practical level, he didn't sacrifice his son, but nevertheless, the thought process in his mind was still there, which means that what he implanted into this ram and the sacrifice of this ram was all of this energy that was the potential of fulfilling God's, bringing about God's revelation in this world. And therefore, all the aspects that come from this ram are really things that Avraham set into motion, and that all David HaMelech doing is bringing into fruition. All Elijah is doing is bringing into fruition. It's like a faucet where it's on, and all you have to do is turn the faucet. Because Avraham, in his mind, is trying to create such energy of revelation of God, and although he did not fulfill it because the child was not sacrificed, the concept in potential, all of this exists, and therefore every element, explains the Or Gedayahu, every element of this ram has within potential of bringing godliness into this world. So that's the mindset of Avraham. That's the mindset of Avraham. Let's look at the ram. The Mutzar Nevim, famous contemporary commentator on Navi, on the aspect of the belt of Elijah, in the beginning of the Malachim Bet, states the following, this is source 4. Oto ayol nivra erev Shabbat ben Hashmashot. This ram was created erev Shabbos, twilight, between Friday night and Shabbos. That time when it's sundown, but not yet Shabbos. It's not dark. It's that middle twilight zone. Now, clearly, we need to understand, as the Maharal points out in source 5, it's not that the physical ram was created then, and he's 2,000 years old, waiting. This poor little ram. When am I going to be sacrificed? Clearly, it's the concept called ram, and the concept of all the things created at that time that was created then. What is so significant and special about this time? So continuing in source 4, Umipnein shebota sha'a chol v'kodesh mishamshim bo be'irbuvya. This is a time when the holy and the profane are mixed. Ki erev Shabbat hu chol, Friday is still the weekday. B'Shabbat hi kulo kodesh, and Shabbos is all holiness. Ubeven hashmashot heima mitchabrin zelazeh. Twilight is the connection between Friday, the profane of the week, and Shabbos, the holy. With the asterisks in four, lachin kol davar sheyesh bazeh hitchabrut shel eretz v'shamayim shuchol v'kodesh mishtamshim bo b'oto ayo. Says the Musar Nevi'im, if the ram embodies this connection between the time, between the holy and the profane, the weekday and the Shabbos, so likewise everything that comes from the ram, the inner connection is the connection between holy and profane, heaven and earth. This is the secret of the ram. The ram created at this time embodies within it those aspects that create this bridge and forge this bond between the spiritual and the regular world. Let's try to understand what this bond is all about before we can get to the various elements. On the next page, in source number 8, Rabbi Feldman in The Juggler of the King, which is the Vilna Gaon's understanding of the parables, he quotes another medrash, a very famous medrash, where the Torah tells us, Eila todot ha-shamayim va'aretz v'hi baram. This is the story of heaven and earth when they were created. And the sages say that the word v'hi baram suggests the reading behei bra'am. With the letter hey, he, God, created them. This world was patterned according to the spiritual reality expressed by the letter hey. A reality, in one letter, this reality of the world is embodied in this hey. What is the letter hey all about? So this is the depth of Judaism, where even in a physical letter of the alphabet, there's so much depth, so much understanding. The letter hey, the next paragraph in 8, in the script used for writing sacred text, is formed by combining two other letters, the dalet, and then the bottom of the hey is a little yud. Two letters that come together, with the yud turned upside down and placed inside the dalet. These two letters, by their shapes, represent the respective realities of the physicality and spirituality. What does a yud symbolize? It symbolizes the idea of a point, a thing which has neither length nor breadth, which exists only as an idea in the mind. Spirituality, too, has no physical dimensions and cannot be perceived by the senses. It can only be apprehended by the mind, therefore its best representation is a geometric point, a yud. That's the yud represents the concept of spirituality. You can't place it into a finite sense of this world. The letter dalet, on the other hand, consists of two spreading perpendicular lines symbolizing the axis of a geometric plane, length and breadth. Thus, dalet represents the reality of the physical world. Now we understand what a hay is all about in source 9. Hay is a combination of dalet and yud, representing the idea of spirituality, the yud, entering into physicality, the dalet. The purpose of creation, when we say that with the letter hey, God created the world, means the purpose of creation is to imbue the material world with the sanctity of the divine. To fulfill this purpose, the Torah, the blueprint for spiritual life, was specifically given to human beings who were created to live in a material world, to use their free choice to develop, in spite of their physical limitations, a sense of closeness to the divine. Because the purpose of creation was that there would be a world where the spiritual yud meets and enlightens the material dalet, the world was created with a hay. He continues, I'll just add this parenthetically, that it's a challenge. It's a challenge to bring in the yud and the dalet, the spirituality into the physicality. And that's why there's a large opening at the bottom of the hay, because it's very easy, by force of gravity, not to accomplish this and just to fall out of it. But there's always a little opening between the little yud and the top of the dalet. There's always room to come back. We know that the room of falling is much greater than the room to bring us back. It's much harder. It's much harder. Now, if we understand that the challenge of the world, and this is what the ayil, the ram, represents, it's a challenge of the hay, the dalet, and the yud, of bringing the spirituality into the physicality, we need to understand how exactly is this done. How are the two worlds interconnected and meshed together? So here, Rav Yerucham Levavitz in Das Torah, in source number 12, points out something very important to us. He says that in the beginning of our parsha, we have Avravinu Vayera Lav Hashem Galonei Mamre, God revealed himself to Abraham. He's in the middle of a spiritual revelation. It's a wonderful moment of closeness to God. And then suddenly he sees in the middle of this revelation three strangers, dusty individuals, coming along the road. And the pasuk tells us Avram turns to them, or turns to somebody and says, "My master, do not leave me." So my master could be these three men, "Don't leave me, come to my tent." Or the other interpretation Rashi gives is, "My master," referring to God. "God, I know we're having a wonderful time of spiritual communion together. Just do me a favor. Can you hold on a couple of minutes? Let me take care of the guest, and when I finish taking care of the guest, I'll come back to you." And in fact, our rabbis learned from this that greater is hachnas orachim, welcoming in guests, than kabbalah p'nei ashchina, than greeting God himself. So explains the Daftar Rabbi Yerucham Zatzal, and he says the following. He says, a communion with God means a relationship with God in worlds that are really beyond our world. It's going off into a mountaintop and having this closeness with God. But that's not what the real essence of this world is. What is the essence of this world? It's greeting in guests. It's bringing God into the physical world. Greater is the physical action of achnasat orchim, of greeting in guests, than even a communion with God. Because we live on this world. And therefore, actions of this world take precedence. And that's why Rav Wolbe in L.A. Shur in source 13 points this out. He says, imagine a person is going to contemplate the importance of giving charity. And you can imagine what he's going to do. He's going to sit and say, "Wow, it's so important to give charity. And when you give charity, you've accomplished so much." And he's going to sit for hours and hours and hours contemplating charity. There's one thing he doesn't do, and that is give charity. All those contemplations is not going to make a person a giving person. What makes a person a giving person is when you reach in your pocket and you take out a quarter and you give somebody charity. We live in a world of action. We live in a world where you have to bring the thought process, the upper world, so to speak, down into the physical, down into the practical. And again, Gedalia Shor, that Salon, or Gedaliahu, explains this so beautifully in another aspect of our parsha. He says in source 15, Yodim anu, we know, ki b'chol ma'aseh ha-mitzvot, in all our actions, lo dai b'machshava l'bad, it's not enough to just have thought. She yesher l'adam l'tzeit yidei chovato b'aseyat ha-mitzvah yidei machshava. One does not fulfill one's obligation through thinking. I'm going to think about the wine of Kiddush, and I'm going to contemplate the wine of Kiddush. I haven't done anything. It's called opening your mouth, lifting up a cup of wine, and now you make Kiddush. She's bonein b'sichlo kol ha-kavanot shel ha-mitzvot. It's a mitzvah. It's not enough just to have the thought process. Ki ha-mutala l'adam. What we need to do, he asiyat ha-mitzvah, is to bring it into the practical world. And he gives a great example. He says, and we don't even notice this. Avraham Avinu is told to take his son. He gets up in the morning. He gets his two servants and his son with him. And what does he do? Vayivaka atzei ola, he chops down some trees to bring on his journey for the sacrifice. So the question the commentators ask is, you know, thank God Eretz Yisrael has trees. Why schlep the trees for 3 days? When you go on that mountain, you'll find some trees, chop it down, you'll have the logwood for the fire. Okay, so Ramban points out perhaps you wouldn't find trees that were appropriate. It has to be wood that doesn't have, you know, animals eating and worms, whatever. But he quotes here, which is one approach, which he quotes here, a much deeper answer of the Noam Elimelech, and he says, is that Abraham was so inspired and so fired up by this communion with God, this relationship of and God requesting of him to take his child, that he wanted to immediately take those feelings and do what with it? Concretize it in physical action. Because the world of thought is not a world of relationship with God. The world of spirituality needs to be put down into the practical world. How did he put it down to the practical world? It's called taking an axe, chopping down trees, and now I've done something concrete to prepare myself for the sacrifice. So we've seen here till now, The ram represents the connection between the physical and the spiritual being created at this time. Avraham's thoughts is thoughts of potential that we need to bring into the actual world. The world itself is the world of the spiritual and the physical that work hand in hand with each other, but it's clear that in this physical world, it has to be a world of action and not a world of thought alone. One last idea, and then we'll get started. And that's Rav Aaron Cutler's Tzatzal in Mishnah Rav Aaron in Source 14, where the asterisk is, he talks about the concept that every action we do has an imprint, makes an impression, and he says, V'ikar zeh nogea uvateva gam l'dorot. It's not only a question that it's going to be important, the world of action, right here and now, but rather it has implications for dorei doros, for generations upon generations to come. There's a wonderful story that Rabbi Krohn brings down in the Maggid series. We're in the late 1800s, almost at the turn of the century. There was a family that lived in Germany who had a lot of sons. And in those days, very frequently, instead of sending your children to school, you would hire what's called a melamed, a teacher. And the teacher would teach the students. So there was a particular melamed in the city which this family used for each one of their sons. And as time went on, he became older, his wife died. So the mother of all these young men would always cook. When she cooked food for her own family, she would always send over some extra food to this melamed. And on Shabbos and Yontif, she'd make him some extra things, and she'd always send the boys over to deliver food, and she did this until ultimately he himself died as well. We move in history a couple of years down to World War II. We're at the start of the Holocaust, and Germans came into this particular town, and now these young men are no longer little boys, they're young men and married themselves. And one of these boys was in an apartment with his wife when he was told the Germans were about to come in any second. If you can run, now's the time to run. And they knew that there was a particular family that was saving Jews in the city. They weren't quite sure if it was at the edge of the town to the right or to the left. The husband said, let's go one way. The wife said, let's go another way. Who has time to argue? He said, let me listen to her. And she was right. They found this particular place. And indeed, this woman saved them throughout the entire war. And not only were they saved, but there were two other families saved with them. And one of them happened to be his brother, his wife, and child as well. So two of the brothers were saved by this particular woman. At the end of the war, when thank God they were saved and they came out of hiding, when they left the apartment, they realized that the apartment they had been saved in all those years was none other than what apartment? The Melamed's apartment. So you see this teacher's apartment. You see that an action done many years beforehand, just bringing food to somebody, has a lasting imprint that it was this same apartment that was able to save two of her children and their families. How do we bridge this gap between the physical and the spiritual world? So what I'd like to try to suggest is that each element in the Medrash is giving us a directive of different elements that we need to work on or that are guides to us in bridging these two. In each of these examples, I'd like to go back to the Chumash of our Parsha and see examples of it. And I'd also like to show where we see how each of these examples have an impact, l'dorei doros, for generations to come as well. We will move from the esoteric to the practical in that continuum. And clearly, all the ideas that we're speaking about here are what we call roshei prakim. We're just touching the tip of the iceberg, and each could be, and maybe one day, will be a shiur in its own right. The first element in the Medrash is that the ashes of the ram became the foundation of the Mizbeach HaPnimi, the inner altar. What does an altar represent? What's the symbolism of an altar? So our immediate reaction is the concept of sacrifice. I'd like to move away from that immediate reaction to a different concept of the altar, and that is the concept of shalom, of peace. We bring on the altar a korban shlamim, a peace offering. The altar is the item that brings peace between man and God. It creates the harmony after we sin to be reinstated in our initial relationship with God. In fact, we know, since it's brought down in Source 17, the end of chapter 20 in the book of Shemot, that when the altar is to be built, it was not allowed to have on any iron. For iron as the raw material of the sword shortens life. The altar has to be a symbol of lengthening of life, a symbol of peace. In fact, we know, the Medrash tells us, that if a couple has to get divorced, and at times, unfortunately, it's inevitable, but even if that should occur, the Mizbeach cries over the disunity that is found between the couple. The Mizbeach, the altar, represents peace. It represents that relationship of closeness. If there is no peace, then what's going to suffer is the Mizbeach on a symbolic level, that it itself sheds tears. What is peace all about? How does peace bridge the gap between the physical and the spiritual? So if we turn to the writings of Rabbi Kurzer in The Art of Jewish Prayer on the blessing, Sim Shalom, God should bring down peace to the earth. So he notes in Source 18 that people's true uniqueness is not in their physical appearance or endowment. Each person's uniqueness comes from God's blessing, each with a soul that has special potentials and ability. Each soul can accomplish only its unique task. As a result, there are unique contributions that need to be made to the world, and these can be made only by each individual. Were we unique only in our physical endowment, then we would have conflicts between our respective physical desires. Peace comes from the inherent unity of the spiritual endowments of all human beings. Our souls do not have the physical limitations that our bodies have. Since all souls derive their uniqueness from the same godly source and are not subject to physical limitations, they can all be unified. And that brings about this knowledge of unity among people. And he continues in 19 that external peace can be seen as a barometer of our internal spirituality. To have peace with each other, we therefore need to develop peace within ourselves. When we request peace, we ask God to unify our physical and spiritual selves. We don't want to have separate identities, being in a spiritual mode at certain times and a physical mode at others. Someone who is at peace with himself integrates his physical and spiritual drive. The concept of peace is within ourselves to bridge that gap of the physical and the spiritual world. We are continuing where the arrow is for our physical and spiritual selves to be integrated with each other. Our physical and spiritual parts should not be at war with each other. We cannot find peace when we attend only to our physical uniqueness and then try to gratify our physical drive. This makes us similar to everyone else in the world. But when we're able to harness our physical drive to serve our spiritual uniqueness, then we truly feel at peace and every moment of life is fulfilling. And that's why with the asterisk is on the bottom, God is one, is not fragmented. The more we emulate God, the more we can receive His blessing. When a Jew finds unity internally and a unity in the external world, then he or she is truly blessed. This concept of peace being the first struggle of trying to create within ourselves, the first directive is to create within ourselves this harmony between the physical and the spiritual. And to be conscious of the physical and spiritual aspects that are within us, and instead of having them at war with each other, to be very cognizant of this and try to bridge the gap between the two. This does not only happen, it starts in the internal world and then moves outward. Where we see that there's dissonance and conflict in the world, our job is to bridge the two, and by bridging the two, we are bringing about a combination on the deepest level of physical and spiritual. There's a great example of this in our parasha, where when Sarah is told she's about to have a child, she bursts out laughing. She says, the most ludicrous thing I've ever heard, basically. She says, my husband is so old and I'm going to have a child. God, relating this back to Abraham, says, you know what Sarah said? She said, she is so old. Can she have a child? Well, that's not what she said. She said, her husband's so old. God changing it for, he is so old. So Rashi points out from the Medrash is that God changed the uncomplimentary reference from her husband to herself in order to bring about peace in this household, which is a panic. It's not like we're talking about newlyweds here. If they're 90 years old or 100 years old, I mean, let's understand what we're dealing with here. But that's what we're dealing with here. That the concept of peace is so important, it doesn't matter what stage of a marriage it's at. We try to create that harmony within a home. When we see the power of peace, and we see its implication for Dore Doros, for many generations, is in the tribe of Levi. We know that originally, this is quoted in Sichos Musar, Source 21, Rav Chaim Shulevitz Tzatzal, originally the firstborn served in the sacrifice to God. And after the sin of the golden calf, they lost their rights, and Levi, who took the initiative, to come close to God, Mila Shem Eli, who's for me to God, come, well, Levi came, they got the honor. The obvious question is, what was it about Levi that made them so special? So you'll say to me, Levi didn't work in Egypt, they were never slaves. Great, I know that. But get, what made Levi so great? So Chaim Shalevi says something very deep. He says, you know where Levi's greatness comes from? That he ultimately has this job of serving God? It comes from when Levi was born. When Levi was born, it was Leah's third child. First one, Reuven, you see my agony. Shimon, you hear my pain. What was Levi was born? When Levi was born, it was Leah's third child. First one, Reuven, you see my agony. Shimon, you hear my pain. What was the meaning of the name Levi? Hapam yilave elai ishi. Now my husband will be drawn closer to me. Now we'll have a close relationship. Levi by its essence means closeness. Levi by its essence means bringing peace between a husband and a wife. This child, Levi, whose name means the closeness of husband and wife, is going to be the child that will ultimately bring about that same closeness, that same element of peace, and he is the one who serves in this job in the temple. First aspect, the aspect of peace, reconciling the physical and the spiritual within us. In the world outside of us, this reconciliation, the more we have a level of peace, the more we have a level of balance in this world. Next level. The harp of David HaMelech. Very fascinating. Tehillim treasurer of fury, he points out in source 22 that no matter what David experienced, good or bad, bitter or sweet, failure or fortune, he never ceased praising and thanking God. You look at the book of Psalms, you see that even in the most dire circumstances, he's praising God. What was the secret of the mysterious ability to rise above every circumstance? So he says very beautifully. Source 23, Rav Yonatan Eibeshitz, a man who himself is no stranger to suffering, writes in Yaros Devash that the riddle of David's incessant singing and good cheer can be solved bechinor with a harp. A careful study of the workings of a harp will give us an insight into David's management of troubles and trials and will serve as a model for our own lives. The harp emits the richest sound when its strings are very taut. The harpist then plucks them, stretching the strings even more tightly before releasing them to vibrate. David saw himself as a musical instrument created for the purpose of making music for God, a music which would be made even sweeter and stronger by tension. Crisis tugged at him from all sides. He was torn in every direction by an endless stream of problems and tribulations. While others might dread such difficulties, David saw himself as a harp whose strings must be pulled tightly to make music and which, unplucked, remains entirely mute. Thus David HaMelech's approach to affliction is no enigma at all. To him, adversity was not an unwelcome intruder, but rather an essential catalyst for meaningful life. He sang constantly under all circumstances, for he was delighted that God endowed him with the strength and skill to make the best of every situation. What does David HaMelech's harp represent? It represents the second aspect of bridging the gap called nisyonot, trials and tribulations. Trials and tribulations do exactly that. We have that in this week's parasha of Elohim Nisat Avraham, and God tests Avraham, the famous Ramban, brought down in Rabbi Katz, Living Inspired, source 25. There's an idea that a test forced one to discover level of one's own inner strength, which were previously hidden. The difficulty of the test brings out that which would have remained dormant without it. It's not Hashem who discovers what you're capable of when you succeed. It is you. Mystically, the concept here is that of bringing the potential into the actual. Before the test, it was a level of power in the personality, which was potential only. After the test, the power become actual, realized in the personality and the world. For Amavino to be able to sacrifice his son is not enough. He must make that ability in action, must bring it into the world. What counts, in other words, is not what one can do, but what one actually does in life. All of us sitting in this room can accomplish a tremendous amount. That's wonderful. That's the world of thought we spoke about earlier today. What God wants from us is a world of action. And so often, God takes us into difficult situations in order to push us to levels that we would not be able to reach on our own. It's the concept of the harp. And he says there are deep correlates to this idea that the neshama, the soul itself, is in a sense potential. And the mystical understanding is that a neshama without a body cannot affect any change. It must be brought into a body, into the finite, tangible world. potential energy is not enough, action is necessary. And we see this by God himself. The fact is, he could have created the world, but what does he have to do? Actually create the world. That's the model for us. We could do many things. We have to move into a world of action. And that's what Nesiva Shalom points out. It's why all of us are tested and challenged in life. It's in order to make us grow as bigger and greater people. Where do we see that this has implications for Dorei Doros, for generations? So again, Mishnas Rav Aaron, Rav Aaron Cutler's Atzal, gives us a number of examples. I'll choose one. And that is Rachel Imenu, for example, when challenged with the fact that her sister might be embarrassed on the wedding day when she knew that she was being switched to Leah for herself under the wedding canopy, she gives over the signs to her sister and doesn't say a word about it to Yaakov in order not to embarrass her sister. This is a challenge for a young lady to go through, to give up her husband in order not to embarrass her sister. This attribute of shtika, of silence, that Rachel Imenu had is a characteristic that is found throughout all of her descendants. The Medrash tells us Binyamin, her own son, knew about the sale of Yosef and remained silent and didn't tell his father. We have the concept of Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, who became anointed as a king, met his uncle and didn't say a word to him. Perhaps the most famous example where we see this is by Esther. Esther is one who did not tell her identity in the king's palace. This one idea of shtika, of silence, is a concept that was passed down from generation to generation. And all of us have that. Difficulties we go through, whatever it is that we've really worked on in life, that's something we give as a gift to our children, and they pass it on for many, many generations. It becomes like a genetic code. First idea of peace, creating within ourselves this balance of the physical and the spiritual. The second, the concept of nisyonos, of trials, where we take our spiritual potential and it's actualized in the physical world. As I said, moving from the esoteric to the concrete, the third level is the belt of Elijah. What does Elijah represent? So clearly Elijah is the personality of a prophet. The prophet is one who communicates with God in spiritual realms and brings God's message down into the physical world. That's the job of the prophet. The belt representing the connection between the physical and the spiritual. We don't have prophecy today. What would be the correlates for us today to understand this connection between the physical and the spiritual that Elijah represents? The answer is clearly prayer, tefillah. We see this in Source 29, the Lonely Man of Faith, Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal. Prayer is basically an awareness of man finding himself in the presence of and addressing himself to his Maker. And to pray has one connotation only, to stand before God. To be sure, this awareness has been objectified and crystallized in standardized definitive text, whose recitation is obligatory. The total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting amorphous subjectivity and to venture into the outside world, a well-formed objective gesture. However, it remains unalterably true that the very essence of prayer is the covenantal experience of being together with and talking to God, that the concrete performance, such as recitation of text, represents the techniques of implementation of prayer and not prayer itself. In short, prayer and prophecy are two synonymous designations of the covenantal God-man colloquially. Indeed, the prayer community was born the very instant the prophetic community expired, and when it did come into the spiritual world of the Jew of old, it did not supersede the prophetic community, but rather perpetuated it. Prayer is a continuation of prophecy, and the fellowship of prayer, prayerful man, is ipso facto the fellowship of prophets. What's the difference between prophecy and prayer? So the Rav points out in Source 30, it's a question of initiative. In prophecy, God takes the initiative, and man is passive. In prayer, man takes the initiative, and God is passive. But as we know, historically, the men in the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset Gadola, when they saw that prophecy was dimming and it was coming to an end, it was at that time, Source 31, in prayer they found the salvation of the colloquially. They're the ones who institutionalized, formalized prayer, which they insisted must go on forever. If God had stopped calling man, they urged, let man call God. And so the covenantal colloquially was shifted from the level of prophecy to that of prayer. What is prayer all about? Clearly not something we can handle in 2 minutes that I'm giving to every subject today, but just to touch on it, the Art of Jewish Prayer, Rabbi Kirshner, he points out that prayer is the vehicle from which we can forge our relationship with God. It allows us to transform ourselves, because through having to ask God to fulfill our physical and material needs, we come to a deeper understanding of self. And this is very important in terms of what we're talking about today, of bridging the gap. When I ask God for physical things in my life, say, God, I really need a car. A car would be very helpful. So the question is, why do I need a car? Why am I asking for this? Am I asking for it so I can show off my friends this beautiful car? Am I asking for it so I can use this object, whatever it is, for spiritual gain? And this applies to everything we ask for. It could include spouses, whatever it may be, children. Are we asking for these things in order to enhance ourselves spiritually and to grow spiritually from these requests? Prayer is the ability to take a relationship with God, a spiritual connection with God, and be able to have a deeper understanding of our physical world, and to be able to appreciate that which I have in the physical world and the blessings that God has given me are meant to be used for spiritual purposes. It gives us direction on how to integrate the physical and the spiritual. And clearly, as he points out in Source 33, that it's not something where we can just think about. It's the power of our words which crystallizes our feeling in a way that demands inner clarification. Until something has been committed to words, it can remain a nebulous feeling. In life, it's not enough just to have this communion in our head. It has to be verbalized. It has to be taken from the world of thought into the world of action. Where do we see an example of the power of prayer in its relationship for Dore Doros for the future is in one of the ideas that I would say rates in my own book as the top 10 that I've ever heard. It's an idea I heard from Rav Matzi Alon, who's a prominent rabbi in Israel, gives parsha classes to hundreds of people a week. So he says that we know that the Avos, the forefathers, were the ones who institutionalized prayer. Avram was Shacharis, and Yitzchak was Mincha, and Yaakov was Maariv, the third prayer of the day, the evening prayer. And the Talmud in Gemara Brachos asks, where do we learn that Avram was the one who brought Shacharis, the morning prayer, into effect? So they quote the verse by Yashkem Avram Abokir, and Avram got up in the morning. Now, here's the key. There are two places in our parsha that says that Avram got up in the morning. One, which is Source 34, we'll read together. Avram arose early in the morning to the place where he had stood before Hashem. This is the next day after the day before he pleaded with God, please save the city of stone, 50 righteous people, 45, 40, 10. The day before he pleaded. He comes back now, stands before God, and while he's standing there and having this communication with God, and he gazes down upon Sodom and Gomorrah. This is his world view as he's looking at with his conversation with God. And the entire surface of the land of the plain, and saw, and behold, the smoke of the earth rose like the smoke of a kiln. And so it was when God destroyed the cities of the plain, and God remembered Abraham. So he sent Lot from amidst the upheaval when he overturned the cities in which Lot had lived. So watch this. He's standing in this place where only yesterday what? His prayer was denied. That's one place. The other place of Vayashkim Avraham Boker is by the Akedah. He's getting up in the morning to sacrifice his son. Now we would normally think, which one would we choose? Be the Akedah. He's getting up to do the service of God. Sacrifice his son, sacrifice, idea of prayer, very easy to see the connection. To explain to Rav Alon, no. The Gemara doesn't choose the Vayashkim Avram Abokir, the one found by the Akedah. It chooses this place here. That Avram rose early in the morning to the place where he had stood before Hashem. Explain to Rav Alon, what's the significance and the power of the fact that the Talmud chooses this section? It says very simply, it's here that Avraham is standing and praying when he sees in front of his eyes that his prayer has not been answered. He sees in front of his eyes. Yesterday he was there praying for the salvation of the city, and today he sees it going up in smoke. He's standing and praying when he knows and aware that his prayer was denied. However, the end of the verse says, and God remembered Lot, remembered Abraham and saved Lot. And because Lot was saved, and Lot went into the cave and had this relationship with his daughters, Moab, that son was born. And from Moab came Ruth, and from Ruth came David HaMelech, and ultimately the Melech HaMashiach. So even in a prayer which he thought wasn't answered, there was one element of the prayer that was answered, the salvation of Lot, and from that salvation sprouted the Messianic line. How we don't know that even when prayer is denied to us, that there may be some element of prayer that has been acquiesced and creates worlds that we're not even aware of. That's the power of prayer. Finally, the last part of the Medrash. I'm leaving the times of Mashiach, which is the total integration of the physical and the spiritual out today, because that's what the definition of the Yom HaMashiach is all about. Right now, we're still in this world as of this moment. What will be next moment, I don't know. But let me speak about where I'm standing right now. What is the shofar blast, the ram's horn in Mount Sinai? Mount Sinai represents the giving of the Torah, and the giving of the Torah is clearly the mitzvot, the commandments that we perform on this world. And this is the most concrete way that we have in front of us to bridge the gap of the physical and the spiritual, to have that little yud of spirituality work with the Dalet of physicality. Rabbi Tatz in World Mass 35, it's remarkable that almost all of the mitzvot consist of physical action. Only a very few are performed by thought or attitude alone. This means that the mitzvot function by performance of physical actions, which activate effects in the spiritual realm. The action takes place here, the result occurs there. There's no reward here because the reward for mitzvah is the mitzvah itself. The reward consists of the effect brought about by the mitzvah, which is experienced by the neshama in the next world. Bonding between this world and the next, where the asterisk is in 35, is affected by mitzvot. The body performs the mitzvah, the neshama, the soul, experiences the result. And since this world is the domain of the body and the next is the domain of the soul, a bridge is formed between them. It says, let us look more deeply. When the body is engaged in performing a mitzvah, the mind should be focused appropriately. The body must perform its work in physicality while the mind transcends the physical, so that the result is a translation of material into spiritual. If the intention of the one performing the mitzvah is in fact to perform a spiritual act, an act of divine service, then the physical action is elevated to the level of spirit, and the bond between material and spiritual has been formed. If, however, the intention is not transcended at all, the mitzvah lives in this world only. This is the power of a mitzvah. It's very, very powerful. And Rabbi Wolbe and Alei Shur in Source 38 points this out, that the world of Torah, the world of the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, is what we spoke about earlier, the concept of potential. There are many mitzvot that exist on the level of potential. How do we access this potential? It's by doing and being involved in the world of action. I take that quarter out of my pocket and I give it to a poor person. What I am doing is elevating that quarter into a spiritual act. It's transcending the physical aspects of this world, and it reaches into levels of the spiritual. That's what Torah is about. Torah is about bridging the gap. It's taking a quarter and making a quarter into a spiritual act. It's taking a piece of matzah and making it into a spiritual act. The whole concept of Torah, as Rav Wolbe points out, is to create oneself anew. And the way one creates oneself is to be constantly involved in the world of action of mitzvot, because by doing a mitzvah, you're creating an entire entity called self. And clearly, we also see that this has applications for Dorei Doros, where the Medrash tells us in Source 37 that all the actions that Avram did in greeting the guests, he got them water. The Jewish people deserved, as a gift from God, water, the well of Miriam in the desert. He gave them food. The Jewish people got manna in the desert. He stood over them. Jewish people got the clouds of glory as protection from them. That we see that which Avram did just not stay within the realm of Avram Avinu, but it affected future generations, that they would get these gifts as well. Rav Wolbe points out that the ultimate level, well, this will conclude and then summarize, the ultimate level of doing mitzvot in this world, of being involved in physical actions, is at 39, Hama'asim mivim lahashra'a heim biyadenu lasotam. Im hadam Yisrael mekayem hamitzvot kitikunam mukhrach habarei kivyachol lashrot hashchina alav. We have the ability, and it's a fascinating and challenging idea, but we have the ability, by doing a simple action in the physical world, to bring about that God's presence should rest on that person through that action. That the hand that gives the quarter is the hand that's going to have the Shekhinah, the divine glory, resting on that hand. This is the challenge of us as individuals, to bridge this gap between the physical and the spiritual. The way we do it is to take the physical world through the directive of Torah and elevate it to the spiritual. So I think in conclusion, what the lesson of this ram is, a very powerful lesson. What the ram is saying is, is that Avram at that moment said, we're here to bring about, as we saw in the work of Yahu, a revelation of godliness in this world. How do we bring about a revelation of godliness in this world is to elevate the physical to the spiritual. Avram imbued within that realm the potential for us to tap into to be successful in this quest that defines us as a Jewish people and what our role is. Each aspect of the realm we're trying to suggest this morning are different aspects on how we can forge the two together to bring the Dalet and the Yud together into the Hey, the way the world was created. One is to the concept of peace, being cognizant of the inner struggles within ourselves, our souls, which make us unique, and to pursue this equilibrium of peace within us. It's a concept of understanding that the trials and the tribulations and the challenges that are presented to us in our lives are meant to bring elakoach elapoel from the potential into the actual, to bring about the revelation of God within our own lives, within our own selves. The third element we saw is prayer, where prayer makes us realize and define the physical blessings that we have in this world and understand them within a spiritual light and have this spiritual connection of God very much connected to the physical. And finally, the most concrete is to take this world and realize it's the place of so much potential action. If we just open our eyes, we can see how many mitzvot we can do in any given day. How many thousands, literally thousands, if not hundreds, that we can do in any day. Helping somebody out, giving advice, smiling, with so much opportunity. And to understand that each and every time we're involved in a physical action, what we're doing is we're creating for ourselves a conduit for godliness to rest in our world, and more particularly on ourselves, and in that way we have bridged the gap between the physical and the spiritual, the ultimate lesson of the Ram created Ben Ashrasho at evening time.